Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and happy to be back in the saddle again, filling in for your normal hosts. Testing drug safety without patients, machines that are better than radiologists at detecting breast cancer and dermatologists in detecting skin cancer, and robots caring for the elderly are all ideas and innovations that we may have heard of recently. Is this just hype or is it really the future? Our topic today is artificial intelligence and robotics in healthcare. Our guest is Pedro Domingos. He's a PhD professor of computer science and engineering at the University of Washington and the author of the book The Master Algorithm. His research interests are in the fields of machine learning and data mining. It may not mean much to you now. Hopefully it'll mean a lot more by the time the program is over. He's the recipient of several significant awards, and I just want to mention, too, a National Science Foundation Career Award, and he has also been awarded a Fulbright Scholarship. I learned of Dr. Domingos while listening to a Scientific American podcast on artificial intelligence, robotics, and health, and a link to that podcast can be found on our website at alaskapublic.org. Dr. Domingos, it's a pleasure to have you join us. Welcome to Line One.
Thanks for having me.
Those of you who are listening, remember you can reach us with questions by calling in during the day, during this next hour at 550-8433, 550-8433, or emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. I always think it's important to start with the basics, and this is a complex field for most of us, I would think. And so when we start talking about the term artificial intelligence, try to help me personally understand that, and let's see if we can get all our listening audience to understand what we mean.
Artificial intelligence is getting computers to do the things that normally require human intelligence, like planning, decision-making, problem-solving, common-sense knowledge, understanding what you see and touch, understanding speech and language, and also learning. So traditionally computers just did very routine things. Now with AI, they're actually starting to do things that you normally would think only humans could do, and these are some of them.
That really just seems, I think, unfathomable. You didn't quite say it, but I've also seen that it part of it is trying to get machines to reason even like humans. Is that fair to say in addition?
Yes, that's one very big subfield of AI is what is called automated reasoning, where the whole idea is to have, for example, in the case of medical diagnosis, computers actually reason about the patient's symptoms and what they might have and what, you know, the right thing to do might be and so on.
What are, I guess the one question comes to my mind pretty quickly is, what are the technological advances? What's the pathway that led us to this point? Can you kind of bring us down the road from maybe the first computer and algorithms and to the point where we can start getting machines to reason?
Yeah, a lot of computer science got started in the 40s and 50s, and AI is no exception. The field started around that time, and the aim was always to get closer to human intelligence in the things that people couldn't see computers doing already. And many of the great pioneers of computer science, like Alan Turing and John von Neumann and Claude Shannon, were all into trying to do AI. Now, of course, the big question is, how do you do that, right? It seems very, very difficult because the human mind, the human brain are so advanced and so complex. And there have been a number of different phases in AI. Originally, or for most of its history, what people tried to do was program the computers to do things that humans did. So, for example, if you wanted to do medical diagnosis, you would interview doctors, ask them, well, how do you diagnose these things? And tell me if this is the symptom and this is that, you know, test result, what would you do? And then put these rules into the computer and then have the computer reason with them. This actually was sufficient to do as well, and in some cases better than human doctors, but it took a lot of effort. It took a lot of interviewing doctors and experts more generally. It took a lot of programming. And in the end, it was often quite brittle, meaning if you went even just a little bit outside of what had been programmed, the computers would fail. So at the end of the day, that approach was not very successful. What has really brought us to the modern age is when people turn to machine learning. So the idea of machine learning is that instead of us having to program the computer and have, you know, tell it what the rules are by which it should reason, we're going to let it learn on its own from data. by observing us, by mining databases. For example, if you have a database of patient records, what the symptoms were and what the diagnosis were, the computer can try from that to induce by itself how to diagnose. And this has been extraordinarily successful, first of all, because learning tends to be much less brittle than this kind of pre-programmed reasoning. And second, because instead of the big cost of interviewing people and programming things, now we have this growing flood of data, and the more data there is, the better the machine learning gets, with essentially no extra work on our part. So there's this wave of more and more things being done with machine learning just by learning from the data that is being produced.
Without thinking about medicine first, I suspect, and I'll see if I'm right, is that all the hubbub-baloo about social media and privacy and data mining that's going on there is a very good example of artificial intelligence being used to look at what's, I guess, called big data, and in my simple way of thinking. It is an example that perhaps most people by now have seen as an example of how artificial intelligence can be helpful.
Definitely, it can be helpful and sometimes also a little bit dangerous. For example, what Facebook does is, or Twitter is maybe an even better example, they have a big AI system that is continuously trying to figure out what tweets to show you. People often think that they just get shown all the tweets from the people that they follow, but that would be impossible because there would be too many. So Twitter is continuously trying to figure out what it is that it should show you, and it does that by learning from what happened before. So if it shows you something and you like it or you retweet it, then it says, oh, you know, you like this kind of thing. So it'll show more of that to you in the future. And as you can imagine, there are vast amounts of data, both from us individuals, but also, you know, based on similar people with similar tastes and so on. So there's this big AI system essentially running Twitter and running Facebook, among other things, deciding, for example, what news we see. The element of this that is a little bit dangerous is that these systems typically are just optimizing what the companies call engagement, right? They just want to keep you on the site because that's how you will see more ads. And often by maximizing engagement, you can actually have negative side effects, like, for example, fake news tend to engage people better than real ones, and the system, you know, is just trying to get you engaged, so it may propagate fake news more than would be ideal. So there's this huge amount of AI power and of mining the data and of learning, but often it's being used in service of very narrow goals. So part of what the companies and I think we as citizens need to start figuring out is, like, what other goals should the AI be serving?
And AI can be used to help with the ethics as we begin to define them, and another issue of even the cybersecurity side of these things, which become an issue also in healthcare as we're looking at lots of private information about health.
Yeah, certainly in ethics, AI systems just work. They're very smart, right? They're not rigid programs, but all that they do is try to achieve the goals that we give them within the constraints that we set. Mm-hmm. Choosing the goals and choosing the constraints is up to us. And so part of what we need to do is figure out how to make our ethics into what is called the objective function of the algorithms, right? For example, you shouldn't just be maximizing engagement, you should be maximizing social good, but what is social good, right? We have to define that in a way that the computer can then optimize. And there is indeed a very, you know, big debate going on about this. I think the role of technologists like myself is actually not to program our ethical preferences into the systems, it's to make systems such that anybody can program their ethical preferences into them. And then different people, different countries, different groups, different societies will do different things. And, you know, there's definitely a lot to be done there and a lot for all of us to figure out, right? So everybody needs to understand to some degree what these systems are doing, not at the level of the details, but at the level of, you know, we have to control them, right? If we don't understand them, you can't take part in the discussion. And at the level of cybersecurity, of course, that is a huge and growing problem these days. And AI is being used extensively in combating, for example, computer intrusion and fraud and viruses and all these things, largely because the attacks that come are never quite the same. So again, it's impossible to just program something that will handle all of them. It has to use machine learning to be continually trying to figure out, you know, what are the kinds of attacks that I'm seeing that are new? How do I prepare for them? This is not done purely by machine. It's not done purely by humans, but it's the combination of the two that's being used and that I think is essential to success.
Let me remind listeners just real quickly, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Pedro Domingos. He's a professor of computer science and engineering at the University of Washington, the author of the book, The Master Algorithm. We're talking about artificial intelligence, robotics, and healthcare. If you've got questions or comments, our direct number, 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number. Those in the state or outside of the state who may be listening, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Is it reasonable to ask, I think you've given us a little bit of a feeling about what AI really does well, but maybe a different question would be, what do they do that's really better than humans can do?
Generally speaking, if you have a task that is narrowly defined and you have a lot of data about it, the machines will do better.
Right.
And this can be in any field, right? It's not. It could be blue-collar work. It could be white-collar work. The things that machines are not very good at are the ones that require a lot of flexibility, a lot of integrating different kinds of information, a lot of common-sense knowledge. Machines really don't have much common-sense knowledge these days. A lot of physical dexterity, for example. So it's actually easier to automate the work of an accountant than it is to automate the work of a construction worker.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, just walking across a construction site without tripping is actually beyond the state of the art in robotics today. On the other hand, anything that you can learn how to do from data, and, you know, medical diagnosis, again, is a good example. But there's others, like, for example, predicting what will happen in the stock market, predicting what you want to see when you issue a search query, predicting what other movies you'd like to see based on other, or products based on other things that you've bought. These are all tasks that AI will naturally excel at, and the more data we have, the better the AI systems will get.
It's just such an intense, so when you're looking at huge amounts of data, it's such an intense amount for the human brain to, one, mind, and then, two, to make sense out of. Machines with the right algorithm, really, that's their bag. They can really do that and not wear out and not get tired and not make mistakes as much.
Yeah, well, so that's one thing. Another one is that machines are very consistent. When you look at the mistakes that humans make, for example, you know, in all professions, but including medicine and justice and whatnot, it's because the same person can say different things in the morning and in the afternoon, depending on their mood and what they're thinking at that point. And they make a lot of mistakes that way. The same person might get something right now and wrong tomorrow, whereas the machines are very consistent. You know, they always do things in the same way, you know, whatever optimal way it was that it was found. And for many problems, this is actually ideal. Another one, of course, is that the machines can learn things that are way more complex than any human mind can handle. So if you have a phenomenon that's very, very complex, like, for example, how a cell works, a cell is a vast network of gene regulation and, you know, reactions and so, you know, like the whole metabolic network, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
There is no single human being that can actually have all of that in their mind, but a computer can.
Mm-hmm.
So computers can just have, you know, a vaster, more integrated amount of knowledge than any human being can. And that, I think, is another aspect in which, as we go forward, you know, they'll become more and more important.
This may be more philosophical, maybe I'm be off the topic. I mean, it seems to me that the human mind may be able to gather all the information about a cell, and that may be stretching it, but they may not be able to recall it, find it, use it as effectively. Is that fair to say, or am I overdoing the human mind even?
Yeah, or connect the pieces. Often what happens is that, you know, I know a piece, you know a piece, but we never put it together, and we actually needed the two pieces to be put together. And the computer is very good at doing that, right? There's one rule that says if A, then B, and then if B, then C, and then it can figure out C from A, which for human beings, if there's a lot of these, then you know, it's too much.
All right. I'm going to go back just a little bit to basics, and hopefully if it looks like we're getting too deep into this, I'm going to back out and we'll get to some examples. But first off, a machine has to somehow look at some data. Sometimes that data is a chart that may be typed into, or and then I'm trying to get to this idea of how does that machine interpret that written or typed or decoded or digitalized information. How effective are we at that? How accurate are we? Because that would seem to be the beginning of using these machines.
Well, for example, suppose that you have a table of patients, and for each patient you have, you know, this was their temperature, this was their blood pressure, this was their, you know, glucose level, et cetera, et cetera. And this patient had diabetes, this patient didn't have diabetes. One thing that the machine can try to do is induce rules that say, oh, if they have this and this, then they do have diabetes. If they have that, however, then they don't have diabetes. So essentially what the machine learning system is doing is trying to discover rules like this. And it's very easy to do that, right? Computers are very powerful. They can search, through many rules in a short amount of time. The key problem is to make sure you don't overfit to the particular data that you've seen. How do I know that the rules that I just took from these patients will also generalize to a new patient, right? When a new patient comes along with a combination of symptoms that is different from all the ones that I've seen before, will I make the right prediction for them? And the way this works is that usually when you do machine learning, you hold out some of the data that the system isn't allowed to see. And then you test it on that data. And if it does well on that data, then we're confident that it really is good.
Mm-hmm. Is it appropriate now to help us try to understand how we can get a machine to reason? That still is interesting to me. I think it gets into what I read about is neural networks and so forth. And I don't want to get too deep, but if you can somehow help us understand how a human might program a machine to begin to reason in a way we can understand it, I would be very interested in that.
Yeah, there are different kinds of AI and different kinds of machine learning. Neural networks are typically not very good for reasoning. Mm-hmm. They're good for perceptual tasks, like understanding what's in an image or understanding speech, that level of thing. For higher level reasoning, the type of reasoning that an expert in some field would do, there usually the best is what's called symbolic learning and symbolic AI, which is manipulating symbols. And the way people developed that was literally by, for example, psychologists doing what's called protocol analysis, which is they tell experimental subjects to solve a problem and talk aloud while they're solving it. Oh, now I'm thinking about this. Oh, wait, this is a dead end. So now let me try to do that. And now there's this sub-goal and that sub-sub-goal. And, let me see how I can get to the end. They actually analyzed how people did this, people solving problems and also mathematicians, scientists, et cetera, and then tried to codify that into a computer program that works roughly the same way. So this is the way a lot of AI has developed. The nice thing is that you can do this on a small scale by interviewing a few dozen people, and they may not be solving very big problems, but then once you know how to do this, then with a computer you can scale it up to much bigger problems with more data, more rules, more complexity, but essentially using the same technology.
Okie doke. Wow. We're about 20 minutes into the program, and this is probably, as far as I'm concerned, a good place to take a brief break. We're going to take a one-minute break. I want to remind listeners you're listening to Line 1, your health connection, our local number again, 550-8433, the toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break and continue our discussion on artificial intelligence and robotics and healthcare with Dr. Pedro Domingos. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Pedro Domingos, professor of computer science and engineering at the University of Washington and also author of The Master Algorithm. Our topic is artificial intelligence and robotics in healthcare. You can call in locally and ask questions in the next 40 minutes or so. Our local number, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number as well, 1-888-353-5752. 5752 or email at line1@alaskapublic.org. If you're listening between 8 and 9 p.m. on a Wednesday evening, then you're listening to a taped broadcast, and we won't be able to help you with that. Before we get into, Dr. Domingos, the some applications and examples, what about the issue of quality of information? We get back to humans are still got to be, it seems to me, directing these machines. The quality of the information, and when we get to reasoning, it seems to me we have to know if we have sufficient information. And we have a certain amount of information, let's say, on genetics of cancer right now, but next week that's different, and that machine then has to be reprogrammed or whatever the right word is. So quality of data, sufficiency, how do we keep up with the changes?
Well, quality of data is essential. Machine learning is only as good as the data that it's being applied to. So if the data is not of good quality, if there's a lot of errors in the data, if there's distortions, biases, et cetera, then the learning will suffer. There are many ways to try to minimize those and compensate for those, but at the end of the day, you're right. The learning needs people to produce and prepare the data in a way that the learning can then work. So ironically, in many ways, machine learning, even though it's all about automating the creation of AI, winds up often being a quite labor-intensive process, and most of that process is actually getting the data in shape to make sure that then the learning actually is of corresponding good quality. Another aspect that you touched on is that in general, in the world, it's very hard to reach certain conclusions about anything, right? You're never absolutely sure. But in particular, when you have, for example, rules that were learned from data, you're never sure if the rules are correct. There's always some probability that they're wrong, or at least wrong for this particular, you know, decision, this particular patient right now. So what a lot of these AI systems do is they reason probabilistically or with confidence. They say, well, this rule holds with this confidence and this fact holds with this confidence, so my conclusion is whatever with the corresponding resulting confidence. So both of those things are important, the data quality and reasoning with probability.
And it follows that you can also then individualize individual patients' recommendations for treatment if we were to go in that direction, because each patient brings their own individual past history, genetics, environmental influences, and so forth. So that further complements it, but obviously that can be accounted for if done well.
Yeah, in fact, you could say that the whole promise of AI is to personalize things. It's instead of having things that are one size fits all, you know, people in insurance companies and, you know, economics and et cetera, they've always been using statistical models for lots of things, and in medicine and public health and so on. But they were population level models. Right, they were just saying the same thing for everybody. The whole beauty of being in this very big data regime is that we actually have these days often more data about one person than we had before about the entire population. So we can learn a model of the person, right? You know, Amazon can learn a model of what you like to buy. Twitter can learn a model of what tweets you like, and Spotify can learn a model of the music that you like. And in the same way, we can learn models of how, you know, a particular patient's, you know, some drugs might be good for some people, but not for others. And machine learning can predict who are the people that it's good for. So personalization is really, in many ways, where the big payoff of machine learning is.
At the beginning of the program, I mentioned that it's maybe possible that we could, at some time, and maybe we already are, I'm going to ask you this, testing drugs' safety without even having patients being involved. And you discussed this in that Scientific American podcast that I listened to. Would you mind going over that again and helping us understand how AI can be used in drug development and developing and looking at safety profiles of drugs?
Sure. So traditionally, drugs were developed and tested in two ways, in vitro and in vivo. You would start out just trying a bunch of things in the laboratory, that's the in vitro part, and then once something looks promising enough, then it would actually get tested typically first on animals and then on human subjects, that's the in vivo part. Now, the problem with that is two things. One is that this was a very trial and error process. And, you know, the drug companies are kind of running out of what you can do that way. So this is one problem. Another problem is that why is the drug development process so expensive? It's actually not the trying out a bunch of things in the lab. It's when drugs go to human trials and then they fail. A human trial can cost billions of dollars and last years. And if then it turns out, yes, well, the drug was good for this, but also has a side effect that makes it unusable, then all of that money was wasted. And AI can help very much with both of these parts. So you can do what is called rational drug design, or sometimes called in silico drug design. So it's not in a test tube, it's not in a live organism, it's on a computer. The computer actually simulates how the drug will work at the level of molecules interacting with molecules. This is the level of knowledge that we actually have today. You can do a big search, effectively do in a computer what might take, who knows, years or, you know, thousands of people working in a lab for a long time, and actually figure out, well, we need a drug that will bind to this target. Let us, you know, search through a space of drugs and find one that looks like it will bind to this target. So this is one part. And, you know, there are companies these days that are doing this. Typically they're startups that get acquired by the big pharmaceutical companies, but there's a lot of progress happening there. The other aspect is the testing of the drugs. The drugs can also be tested in silico. So increasingly what happens these days is that the same kinds of machine learning that we've been talking about can be used to predict whether, for example, a drug will be, you know, will cause cancer or not, or will have, you know, or will be toxic in one way or another. Again, by learning, for example, rules, or it could be a neural network, from the drugs that we know, whether they're toxic or mutagenic or whatever, and generalizing from those to new drugs. And then when a new candidate drug comes along, it gets put through these machine learning systems, and often what they do is they kill candidates. And killing those candidates is very good because it saves all the money that would have been wasted if those things had gone on to in vivo trials. And then the ones that survive, right, those usually are now much better selected to actually, things that will likely work and not have negative side effects. And then a final aspect, you know, goes back to the personalization aspect, is that we are actually now coming into a world where it's no longer the case where a drug should either be approved for general use or not approved. If you have a drug that only works for 10% of the people that have a particular ailment, traditionally that drug would not be approved because it would be useless for 90% of people. What happens is that if you can predict which 10% of the people, based on their genome or their medical history or, you know, other or phenotypic, you know, characteristics of the individual, if we can predict who that drug is good for, and within those people, it works 95% of the time, then maybe that drug can be approved and, you know, maybe save lives that before wouldn't have been saved.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that last technology or innovation is probably already being used to some extent in cancer chemotherapy, where we're learning that certainly cancers are all not the same and that individuals may metabolize drugs differently, and we're also learning that our microbiome, particularly in our gut, may affect response to medications. This may be already being used, particularly in cancer. Are you aware of that?
Yeah, so cancer is a great example precisely because it's so complex. Cancer is not one disease, so there's no one drug that's going to cure cancer, right? Everybody's cancer is different. You know, every tumor has different mutations, and the same tumor now and 3 months from now will have different mutations. So it's a moving target. And the way to catch that moving target is not with a single drug, but with something like an AI system that predicts what will be the right drug to use. And these days, you can already, for example, get a biopsy, you know, the tumor gets sequenced and they found where the mutations are. And then you can get a report from the company that actually recommends, you know, what are the possible drugs for those particular mutations, even sometimes experimental drugs that the trials are going on right now that you might be able to participate in. So this is already starting to happen. Having said that, cancer is very, very hard. Mm-hmm. Right? Many other, you know, for example, like radiology these days, you can have a neural network do radiology very, very well, often detecting things that a human being wouldn't, or, you know, dermatology and so on, and, you know, et cetera. Cancer is really hard because the molecular biology of how it works is very intricate. So the extent to So in some ways, machine learning systems are worse at cancer today than they are at many other things, but so are people. And what we're going to see, you know, over the years, and some of this is going to happen in the fairly near term, is these programs that recommend, for example, a course of action for a particular patient based on her, you know, genome and the mutations of her tumor, they will get more and more sophisticated, you know, down to the point of, for example, instead of recommending an existing drug, it may realize that none of the existing drugs would work, and they can actually go and design a drug for that patient and then recommend that drug.
Another area that I mentioned at the beginning of the program and you just briefly touched on is the radiology and dermatology and how machine learning can speed up the work of radiologists and can be, I'm trying to choose my words carefully, I want to make sure you correct me if I'm wrong, be equally effective in diagnosing malignancies, and maybe even better at identifying lesions that we should not even have to worry about, so the false positives. And the same being said of dermatologists with skin cancers. Is that true? And give us some feeling about how much that might be being used now or in the near future.
Yeah, so this is one area where neural networks excel. It's about looking at an image and figuring out whether there's a tumor there, for example. You know, looking at a X-ray of somebody's lungs, and you want to pinpoint where there is a tumor. And it's important both to detect them when they're there, but also not to hallucinate one when it isn't there. And again, it's important to do it consistently. And machines have become very good at doing this for a couple of reasons. One is that there's a lot of data, right? There's a lot of radiology results. There's a lot of both the images and what the diagnosis were. This is typically what they're learning from, is databases of what was there and, you know, the image and then what the radiologist or the dermatologist or whatever said. So there's a lot of data for that. And then the reason they excel is that often they can detect things that are subtle or that are patterns that human beings are not used to dealing with, so that we would naturally miss. So there are some things that are easy and everybody, machine or human, can get those. But then there are things that are often quite subtle and often human beings didn't know to detect them before, but then once this gets tested and has been tested, it turns out that, yes, they actually were picking up on something real. Mm-hmm. And also sometimes there's things that people might think were, you know, a pattern, were the shape, for example, of a tumor, but aren't. And again, machines are very good at this because they can learn from a huge amount of data, right? It's not that they're smarter than humans. Machines are still nowhere near as smart as humans, but a machine can look at more X-rays than a radiologist would do in his entire lifetime, right, in a matter of minutes.
Right. So it might be that the real applicability, let's talk about radiology, is these machines are screening large numbers of X-rays much more rapidly than the radiologists, identifying those that need to be really closely looked at so the radiologist would double-check them. And then I guess the other thought that comes to my mind is the machine may also pull out those that the radiologist might miss because of fatigue or bias or being distracted during the course of his work.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of the uses of machine learning, and by the way, this is not just in medicine, is actually just to pre-screen things for people. And often what this lets you do is look at far more things than people could have looked before. So in the case of medicine, what's going to happen, and what is already happening, is that people can be, instead of going to the doctor once a year, they are continuously being diagnosed by, for example, the sensors on their cell phone, right? There's no way that you could have a doctor 24/7 looking at the vital signs of a human being, but once there's an AI system there, this actually can happen. So in a way, what it does is, because this has become so easy and so cheap, it can actually be done on a much larger scale. So, you know, you can look at more variables, you can look at more people, you can look at each person more often, often second by second. This is where a lot of the impact is going to be.
And I guess that's kind of creeping us into sensors, portable sensors, wearable sensors, and the idea of robotics, which I guess is the way I'm beginning to think about it, is just a machine that's using artificial intelligence in a very specific way.
Yeah, well, a robot is, the brain of a robot is the AI, right? The same way that we have brains, a robot has to have an AI to control what it does. And then, of course, there's also the mechanical and electrical part. But you're right. What does, you know, sensing has become very cheap, right? There's sensors all over the place, and in particular, your cell phone has a whole bunch of very useful sensors. It has an accelerometer, it has audio, it has GPS, it has all of these things, right? And what we are discovering is that, for example, you can learn to early diagnose things from even the way people are typing, or the tremors in their voice, or how much they hesitate when they say something, or even the particular things that they're asking the search engine about. So all of these things we're applying machine learning to. And of course, another aspect is like, well, what new sensors could actually put on your cell phone that would be useful to do a broad range of health monitoring and medical diagnosis? And, you know, and there's even been this contest to do like a tricorder, right? Like the thing on the enterprise that you can basically use to, you know, sense and diagnose and a lot of this is happening. You can put these things in silicon, and then they're just available on you 24/7. So, you know, like a few months ago, there was a man, I think it was in China, who said his life was saved by a cell phone because it detected that he was about to have a heart attack. I mean, in the future, I think your cell phone will call 911 if it thinks they're about to have a heart attack before you even know.
Right. Speaking of heart attacks or myocardial infarctions, it seems to me I just read something that's probably related to using artificial intelligence, although I don't know for sure. There's been a report that a physician or a group of researchers have identified a genetic predisposition to myocardial infarction. A large percentage of people who die of myocardial infarctions, heart attacks, have a particular genetic risk. And so that must have taken a lot of data mining of the genetics as well as the clinical outcomes to make that correlation. And so now he thinks we're at a point where we may be able to screen individuals for this particular genetic risk and do something, hopefully, to prevent that outcome of a death from myocardial infarction. I don't know if you were aware of that or it's certainly have any comments about the use of AI and getting that kind of information.
Yeah, there's this whole area called genome-wide association studies where what you try to do is you have the sequence genomes of a bunch of people, and then what you try to do is correlate mutations, are often called SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, and correlate those with things in the phenotype, with disease outcomes for the person. One by one, people are discovering these connections. Sometimes they turn out to be real, sometimes they turn out to not be real. But in many cases, this is actually very useful, not just for diagnosis, but for people being aware, even, you know, very early on, of what, you know, things they're at risk for.
All right. We're almost 40 minutes into the program. I want to take another short break. Remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We do have one email asking about robotics and surgery, and we're going to get to that after this break when we continued our discussion of artificial intelligence and robotics and healthcare with Dr. Pedro Domingos. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. We'll be right back.
Funding for Line 1, Your Health Connection, was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you. It's back to school time. Backpack ready, school supplies check. But what about your child's vaccinations? Before school starts is a great time to talk to your health care provider or a local public health center to make sure your child's vaccinations are current. Vaccinations protect your child and the whole community against serious diseases. Learn more, including where to get free vaccines, at immunize.dhss.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by DHSS.
All right, welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. And I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest is Dr. Pedro Domingos. He's a professor of computer science and engineering at the University of Washington and the author of The Master Algorithm. Our topic is artificial intelligence and robotics. We've kind of worked our way through some of the basics in artificial intelligence. And the last part of the program, we're going to kind of dovetail this artificial intelligence with robotics and learn a little bit more about how those two innovations, I'll say, are being used in what the future might be in healthcare. If you've got questions, you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org over the next 15 minutes or so. Our local number, if you want to call, 550-8433, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 p.m. on a Wednesday, you're listening at a taped recording. So let me just start with the email that came in. And the question is, what are the pros and cons of robotics versus humans in performing surgery, particularly, he says, such as knee replacement? So one area it's very common, one of the earlier times robotics have been used have been in obstetric and gynecology and in orthopedics in particular. So what do robots do better? What can be problems with robots in surgery?
So we should distinguish between two kinds of robots in surgery. One is where there's a robot doing the surgery, but the robot is operated by a human surgeon.
Okay.
And the other one is where the robot is autonomous, so the robot is doing the surgery all by itself. The former type is already fairly widespread today. The latter is, you know, something that's at the experimental stage and is coming, but they are, and of course, one enables the other. We already have robots today that are extremely high quality and very precise, right, and can do things with a, you know, quality and certainty and precision that an unaided human being couldn't do. Part of that is just the mechanics and the not getting tired and so on. Part of that is the perception, right? Human beings have a visual system that sees in 2D from one particular direction, whereas these days you can actually have a 3D picture of the internals of a person that is continually being updated, and the doctor can actually look at that, sometimes even superimposed on the actual patient, and operate based on that. This now forms the infrastructure to then have the robot be, actually have the robot do the surgery all by itself. Now, there are pros and cons in using robots. Some of the pros is that the robots can be more reliable than humans. Again, it goes back to that whole issue of consistency. Some of the cons is that the robots don't know, right? So it takes, often at the end of the day, it takes human judgment to decide what to do. And this, I think, is actually where there's still a lot of progress to be made, you know, before, you know, the robots can be fully autonomous. So I think what you're going to see over time is a mix of these things. Sometimes it'll be purely a human job. Sometimes it will be a mix of the two. Sometimes it will be just a robot, depending on what the problem is. But I think the one important outcome of all of this is that surgery traditionally was a very, you took a long time to recover from surgery. And these days, actually, increasingly, you can have surgeries that are a precision job. And as a result of which, they do very little damage, they fix what needs to be fixed, and then the patient can recover very quickly. And we're going to see more and more of this as time goes by. Not only as the robots get better and more dexterous, you know, that's sort of like the traditional Da Vinci robot, but also as they get miniaturized. Right, we can make robots very, very small, much smaller than anybody's fingers, and you know they can operate that way with minimal damage to tissue, et cetera, et cetera. So we're going to see more and more of this as time goes by.
We have a caller. I want to take that. Jonathan, you're on line one.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. It's a very interesting subject. My question is sort of fitting into your second half here. It's like my question was, what is AI currently being utilized in healthcare, and what types of jobs would there be available coming up that people might be interested in considering in this type of area for healthcare and robotics and so?
All right. You kind of broke up there a little bit. Dr. Domingos, did you hear that?
So what kinds of jobs will there be in AI for healthcare? That was one question. Is that right?
Right.
Yes, in AI, and also what is currently being utilized for robotics and AI in healthcare?
Right. So these days, AI is being used to do a lot of, for example, things like diagnosis, radiology, dermatology, just, you know, diagnosing things based on symptoms. There's an increasing amount of use being done there. Also things like, for example, patient care. Nurses before might have needed a doctor or a doctor might not be available. Now some of that can actually be done by an AI system that, for example, is continuously monitoring somebody's, you know, vital signs and, you know, sends an alert when there's a problem. Another area where we're starting to see use of AI and robots is, you know, robots just carrying things around the hospital, something, taking something from, you know, I need an instrument now, and the robot goes get it for me. Another area where robots are being used is in elder care. Often those robots, ironically, are not very dexterous as robots, but they're more there to, for example, remind people of what they need to do, give them emotional support. And the fact these robots often have a human form, even though they're clearly robots. And interestingly, that tends to work very well. Obviously, it wouldn't be as good as it's not. You know, it would be better to have a nurse there, but of course, you know, in many cases, people can't afford to have a nurse full time, and so the robot can be very helpful in that context. So there's a whole, you know, series of ways in which AI and robotics is being used today.
Jonathan, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Another thing that I think I recall reading and preparing for the program and talking about robotics and surgery is that the robotics, when we get into these fine surgical things, don't have the natural essential tremor that all humans have, and that may be of some benefit. I didn't hear you mention that. And the other thing was that robotics would not be limited to the senses that us humans have. They may be able to see and recognize things that we can't see as humans. You want to comment on those?
Exactly. So both of those are true. Robots are incredibly steady, steadier than a human being could possibly be. And this is useful even if the robot is being controlled by a human. So these Da Vinci robots that are in many hospitals now, a human is controlling it, but at the end of the day, the operation is done much better precisely because one of the reasons is that the robot is so steady and so precise and, again, doesn't get tired. Often these things last for many hours, and human beings are subject to fatigue. So definitely the case. And there was another thing you mentioned.
The senses, you might be able to, a machine might be able to recognize things that our senses, taste, feel, sight, and so forth, smell, may help in surgery.
Exactly. Human beings have the senses that evolution endowed us with. They were good for the things that we had to do over the course of evolution. Those are not necessarily the ideal things to have if, for example, you're performing surgery. When we're designing a robot for surgery, you can give it whatever sensors you think will be useful, and then, of course, the AI will take care of integrating them and figuring out what to do. So, in a way, our imagination is the limit.
Another interesting thing that I had come across was the idea that these sensors can be much more, I guess they're gets back to senses and their ability to detect changes in health before humans can. And the example was in neurologic diseases, for example. It's very important with certain kinds of stroke to intervene very, very rapidly. That requires recognizing things as quickly as possible and then all the technology being present and that kind of. But the sensors might actually allow a much quicker recognition of movement patterns that are suggesting a stroke before the person or a doctor could even recognize it, leading to a much more rapid intervention and a better outcome.
In fact, this is an ideal type of problem for machine learning because if you have the temporal history of what happened, these things happen and then the person had the stroke, then you can try to predict the stroke from the things that happened before.
Mm-hmm. I do want to make a comment also, or get your comment actually, something that Jonathan, the caller, had just recently. And as I was listening to podcasts, which is kind of my bad habit, I was listening to Sam Harris in his Waking Up podcast one day, and he was interviewing Andrew Yang, and they were discussing universal basic income, which for many people would sound, that just doesn't make much sense. But then they got into this issue of how robotics and artificial intelligence are really going to appear to change work in a very dramatic way, much like what happened in the Industrial Revolution. And as I recall or have written down, the comment was 40% of current jobs are going to be lost.
due to AI and robotics and so forth, truck drivers, they mentioned radiologists and so forth. So this gets back to what John was saying, that there's going to be a potentially a huge disruption in work and economic consequences. You certainly must have heard of this and read about it and been aware of it. What are your comments?
I think that these fears are overblown. You have to remember that 200 years ago, almost all Americans were farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're not all unemployed now. We're just doing jobs that we couldn't even imagine back then. Like, for example, app developer. That job didn't exist even 10 years ago. So what people have to realize is that for every job that disappears, there's another job, or sometimes more than another job, that gets created. Partly it's because when it becomes cheaper to do something, you can do more of it. And really what AI does is it lowers the cost of intelligence. So yes, some jobs will disappear, but then a whole slew of things will become possible that weren't possible before. A good example is ATMs. People thought that ATMs would cause massive unemployment among bank tellers, but there are actually more bank tellers today than there were before the ATMs.
Right.
It's just that they're doing other things than handing out cash,
right?
They're recommending mortgages to people or, you know, advising them on investing and a whole slew of other things. Same thing today, right? There's already a lot of AI being deployed, but the unemployment rate in the U.S. today is actually as low as it's ever been.
Right.
So there will be demand for more of some old jobs because they'd be done by AI. Some jobs will shrink, but there'll also be totally new kinds of jobs. I think, there are these statistics like, 40% will disappear. There are more recent studies that say it's actually much less. The studies that are more careful, what they show is not so much that jobs will disappear, but that certain tasks within each job will be automated. And I think this is actually the reality for most people, is not that their job will disappear or that there will be a totally new kind of job that maybe they will do in the future, is that the way we do our jobs will change. We will automate some parts as a result of which we will have more time to do other parts and do those better.
One of the problems in healthcare, particularly in the United States, but worldwide, is the issue of cost. And in addition to cost, there's, in the United States, again, access issues, and then there's quality issues. Do you see artificial intelligence as having a net benefit to cost, access, and quality in healthcare?
Yes, all of those. So certainly AI has enormous potential to lower the cost of healthcare because it's a form of automation. And when you automate things, they become less expensive. So that one, I think, is fairly clear. Also in terms of access, because AI can make, in essence, medical expertise much more widely distributed, right? There isn't this bottleneck of the number of doctors and nurses available. For the most important things, you will still need to have them. And again, there might be more in the future than there are now. But there will be a lot of more, point of care, everyday access that people will be able to have that they didn't before. And again, with quality, when we have machines able to do things, we can always still choose to use whatever combination of machines and humans and give the best quality. And so it's not, we don't actually lose anything. We just, gain the ability to do a lot of things better in the cases where they would be better. And again, we do have this, we can see at this point, just looking at, recent history, that there are a lot of things that machines can do more consistently with higher quality, with higher accuracy. And so this obviously, this will be passed on to the patient.
I have another question that just came in, and I think we have time to address it. And the email says, in my experience, doctors increasingly do not do physical exams, but do an interview and then make their diagnosis and recommendations. My first comment just about that statement is the history is often much, much more important than physical examination. But that's my bias, but I think it's well known in most situations in physicians. Then the second part of the question was, or the comment is, with increased use of robots and computers being used for interviews and diagnosis, does this mean that doctors may become less relevant in the future?
Actually, so these two questions are related. I think what I see happening is that doctors, for example, my doctor uses the web, and 10 years ago she didn't. And she uses the web as a backup for her own knowledge. And increasingly what we're going to see is that the patient history will, first of all, be better kept, right? Right now it's a little bit patchy and, you know, variable quality, et cetera, et cetera. There will be a better patient history. There will be a better set of tests that are done on the spot. And then these all have to be integrated into diagnosis and, you know, therapeutics and so on and so forth. And I think the doctor will still be a crucial part of that. They'll just be doing it at a higher level than they do it today, which actually, by the way, I think will mean that the job of the doctor will be more interesting than it is today.
We're into our last 2 or 3 minutes, and I'd like to end by just asking you, what do you want listeners to take away from? What are the important bullet points, couple of them, that you want people to remember?
I think it's very important to people to realize that, first of all, AI is not some science fiction scenario. It's something that is already a reality today in your daily life, in the things that you do, both with computers and without. One of the most common reactions that I have from people who read The Master Algorithm is, oh, I thought this was science fiction, but it's already happening. So people need to be aware of what exists today so that they can then, as individuals and as professionals and as citizens, make the best use of the technology, right? Technology is power, and the power, will be used by whoever wants to use it. So we have to realize, for example, that, here's how I should use AI in my job, or here's how I want AI to be used in the public sphere. So all of these things, I think it's important for people to have a good understanding so they can then make their own decisions. And again, this does not mean understanding things, it's like a car, right? You don't need to understand how the engine works. That's for the mechanics and the engineers. But you do need to understand how to, the steering wheel and the pedals work so you can drive the car to go where you want, and it's the same thing with AI.
All right. Well, my thanks to Dr. Pedro Domingos for joining us today. If you would like to continue this discussion on artificial intelligence and robotics and healthcare, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link on our website at alaskapublic.org, where you can also find resources for today's program and the Line 1 archives. Dr. Domingos, thanks once again. I hope our listeners enjoyed it as much as I did. This has been very interesting and, I think, very important information for people to be aware of.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
You too.
Next week, Line 1 will return, and Dr. Jay Butler will be interviewing Dr. Stephen O'Keefe of the University of Pittsburgh, and they're going to be discussing the relationship between dietary fiber, microbes in our intestines and maybe elsewhere, and colon cancer risk. So dietary fiber, microbes, and colon cancer risk. That's Wednesday, August 22nd at 10 a.m. It repeats that same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1. Alaska Public Media. Please note that Dave Waldron produced today's program. Eric Bork is our web editor. I enjoyed very much the opportunity to interview a guest today on Line 1 and hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.